Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, in the first half, we talked to a couple of experts in shootings, school shootings, psychology, very interesting and sort of no-nonsense people, not the stuff you hear on most of the news shows. We have Dr. Mark Zimmerman and Marissa Randazzo, and they're both just bring a ton of insights into these kind of catastrophes, and then we get beyond it. But it's very interesting discussion, so we'll talk to them right after this.
Hey guys, Michael Malice here. Be sure to check out my weekly podcast, You're Welcome with Michael Malice, now on Podcast One. You might know me from my terrible Twitter, my horrible books, or the nonsense I spout on podcasts like Rogan and Glenn Beck. It's all there. Are you black-pilled or white-pilled for the future of the UK? What is a man?
What is a man?
What is a... No, what is the, are you white-pilled or black-pilled? No, seriousness, girl.
No. I love the Jesse Lee piece of question.
The fact that you discovered that gives me hope for some of the things that I've still got that are missing.
Well, if you need James G. Blaine's autograph, you are welcome to it. Of course, being the co-author of How to Have Impossible Conversations makes you the perfect guest for this train wreck of a show. New episodes are available every Thursday on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, and wherever you get your podcasts. You are welcome.
Available now for pre-order, Adam's sixth book, Everything Reminds Me of Something. Advice, answers, but no apologies.
It's insane. I blame everybody but me.
Adam drops knowledge, rants, and laughs, answering actual questions from you, the listener, and some celebrity friends. Follow the link at adamcarolla.com to purchase on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or through IndieBound to find your local independent bookseller. Everything Reminds Me of Something, coming this summer, wherever finer books are sold. From Carolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Adam's guest today, Bill Bellamy. With Gina Gratt on news and Bald Brian on sound effects, plus we'll talk threat management and firearm violence prevention with doctors Mark Zimmerman and Marissa Randazzo. And now, a man who's always had a lot of thoughts, but never a lot of prayers. Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice. We're going to mandate you get it on. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for telling a friend. We love that about you. Right, Gina Gratt?
That's right.
And Bald Brian?
Suck on some beef.
So we're going to talk to Dr. Mark Zimmerman, who's a PhD, and he's going to approach this whole gun violence, school shooting craziness from a little more of a psychological standpoint. And that's his background, at least as I know. And then we'll talk to Marissa Randazzo, who's also a PhD, but she'll talk about it more of a threat, physical, you know, hardening of targets. I think she was a, I'll look down her thing here, but she's got quite a resume. And she was a Secret Service agent and all that. So we'll discuss the psychological part of it. And we'll discuss this sort of practical, physical part of what we can do with the school shootings and grocery stores and beyond in this country. Which
soft targets, I believe you've referred to them as, and they're referred to as, right?
Yeah, my feeling is there's an aspect of this that has to do with gun control. There's an aspect of this that has to do with where are the parents, where are the psychologists, where
who's
are the counselors, who's intervening, who's, you know, no one's ever going to see it before the parents see it. So to me,
ostensibly,
this is a breakdown of the family unit. And there's a strong psychological component. There's a strong familial component. And then there's this practical component to it, which is, you know, we reinforce the cockpit doors of commercial airliners because somebody went through those cockpit doors.
Right. But and I was also thinking, you know, dangerous and dumb people who that often intersects make it so much easier, I would think, for authorities to catch them because they're always posting about shit.
Yes.
And this kid posted about shit. So why how do we get that alert? How do we tighten up that alert?
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to do that. And we're also going to have to talk about the parents a little bit here. I have no I used to say to Dr. Drew all the time, back when his triplets were 2 years old, I would, because I after doing Loveline for as long as I did Loveline, I was like, I think most of this stuff can be traced back to the home. And, but, you know, a lot of the homeless stuff we're talking about, most of the problems, you know, there's school shootings, then there's homelessness, then there's inner city gang shootings, but we could all go back to the home and go, what the fuck's going on with the parents here? Why is your kid sleeping on the street, or why is he running around at 4 a.m. in Chicago with a pistol and he's 15, or why is he living at home with you and yet putting together an arsenal and putting on, you know, flak jackets and posting stuff on the internet.
And by the way, hard not to notice this kid, because the New York Post reports that he was cutting up his face with knives for fun. Mm. So maybe at the breakfast table you'd notice something a little different?
Yeah. And the problem is I don't think there's a breakfast table. And that's the problem. I mean, the guy shot his grandma before he left. The guy shot up the supermarket in Buffalo. I think he shot his mom before he left. I mean, there's a lot of breakdown in the family unit. And what I used to say to Drew is, like, look, if your kids were just everyone's kids, your triplets, then we could all sleep with our doors unlocked at night, and we could all throw our backpacks on the passenger seat of our cars, whatever neighborhood we're in, and leave.
Poor Chris.
We don't have to worry about any of this stuff if the parents are doing the parenting. So
on that note, yes. I came across an interesting article today, retweeted by friend of the show, guest of the show, conservative pundit Matt Lewis. He retweeted a really interesting article. I read the whole thing, and I don't know if Ben has it. I sent it to him earlier, but it's about the author. I didn't look into who the author was. I just found it interesting. The author is like, we need to have an enforce. Key of the force, red flag laws, like what you're talking about, which is
this,
and he had an interesting chart in the article, which
David
was,
French.
Oh, there you go.
So says Chris.
In every one of these school shootings, there have been red flags. Like, literally, people have reported, like, hey, this guy's acting weird. This guy, or that guy's been 5150'd or whatever for a day or two and then released, or questioned and then released. There should be red flag. I'm interested to talk to our experts about this, because it sounds great to me. How do we put this into practice? But, like, if there's something going on, whether it's the parents or the friends or the teachers or whoever notices it, put that on the, you know, have that red flag go up.
I'm glad you said that, because I think when a lot of everyone says there has to be some sort of mandate, laws, policies, everyone just assumes everyone wants to take their guns away. That this is not that.
No.
There's so many other options, and hopefully our guests can help us with that.
Well, part of the problem, as I'm thinking back, is we have a set of laws and we've constructed a society that when the North Hollywood bank robbers were pulled over, I think in Eagle Rock, California, before the bank robbery, they popped the trunk, and in the trunk was a bunch of automatic weapons, AR-15s, banana clips.
Y'all drive safe now.
Flak jackets. And police scanners.
Jesus.
With, like, zip ties and duct tape. And they went, well,
not technically legal.
They hadn't robbed anything yet. And they literally put them both in for a few months. And when they got out, they gave them back their shit.
That was another article I read. I've been reading a lot about this, obviously, and someone pointed out, like, there's a lot of good and legitimate and legal reasons why people want guns and ammo and they should be able to buy them. There's not a lot of good and legitimate and legal reasons to buy and own body armor.
Yes, that's something we were talking about last week.
It's really hard to get body armor.
Then again, if it's open carry, Wild Wild West in Texas, I'm going to buy body armor to walk around.
Well, now you can wear it.
Yeah, sweet.
Dr. Mark Zimmerman is ready. I don't know if he's zooming in or it's going to boot him up. Oh, there he is. Dr. Mark, can you hear us okay?
I certainly can.
From the Institute of Firearm Injury Prevention. So that sounds like a good institute and a good guy to speak to, especially at this chapter in this country. Thanks for joining us. So give us your qualifications and then your takes on some remedies, perhaps.
The qualifications? I'm a professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan, also in psychology in our combined program in education and psychology. I've been studying youth violence prevention for the better part of 30 years. And most recently, you can't study that work without kind of getting into the issues around interpersonal violence around firearms. And so recently we were funded by the National Institutes of Health to study youth and firearms and create a national consortium to talk about some of these issues, everything from policies, as what you were talking about just now, to specific behavior change strategies. And then that morphed into what the University of Michigan now has invested into this larger institute.
So what are some of the conclusions you've drawn?
Well, it's really complex. I mean, mass shootings account for about 1% of all firearm-related deaths in the United States. Yet when the mass shootings occur, they certainly raise our consciousness. So I do want to point out that about 8 children die every day. 8 children under the age of 18 die every day from a firearm. And that may be from homicide, suicide, or in some cases, unintentional killing. So while these are horrific and we have them too often, they are surprisingly not the most important or focused problem. Having said that, we have to do something about it. We have to think creatively. We have to think across the spectrum of from individual behavior to policies, as you were talking about earlier. Most of the mass shootings in schools are male. Most are handguns. Most of the children who commit the crime are either a student in the school or an alumni of that school. And most got that handgun from the, and by most, I mean like close to 75% got that handgun from home or the home of a relative. And so that points to all sorts of things that we can do for prevention. And that's some of the work that we're trying to focus on in the Institute.
Yeah, it seems, we're interesting in that we're sort of wired. So you say, 1% or less than 1% are from mass shootings. And we're kind of, and meanwhile, people are just getting shot in Chicago all day, every day. And look, a kid's a kid, you can do it all at once in a horrific way and kill 19 of them. Or you can just have a Labor Day weekend where 19 kids get shot, in a few big cities across the country. And practically, it's kind of like if you heard about 30 people drowning because a boat turned over in the bay, you go, oh, but if one person was killed by a shark, we'd be horrified. Like, we're like, oh, we got to snap into action. We got to put nets up. Like, this is nuts. And
yeah, but the island.
Yeah, we're wired that way as human beings to kind of look the other way for many of the killings that just take place that are almost sadly routine nationally on a weekly and daily basis. And then something grabs our consciousness and everyone snaps into action, or at least attempts to snap into action. But yeah, I'd like to address the school shootings, but I'd like to also address just the rando 15-year-old. There was a, I don't know if you guys saw this, and Chris, you can probably find it, but there was a thing in Chicago where a culinary student was just coming home from a night out in a decent part of town, and some guy wanted his cell phone, and they kind of wrestled. And at some point, he took the cell phone, and the guy was just laying on the ground. And he just kept shooting him while he just laid there. And it's not a school shooting, and it doesn't really grab the national headlines. But that person is every bit as scary as the school shooter to me, as long as they're at large.
Well, absolutely. And again, I don't want to minimize the school shooting or any school shooting. 6% of kids say they carried a weapon in school. If the average school, it has 500 students, and which it does in the United States, the average high school, that's 30 times that somebody is bringing a firearm to school, whether it's mass or individual, an individual shooting because they were disrespected. The other thing that's, I think, really important to point out is most mass shootings are not in schools. So on the one hand, everyone's concerned, and there's all of this trauma that occurs that we often don't talk about, like what now, the families of the lost children or teacher, of course, are majorly affected by that. But the school, whole school community is affected by it. The whole community where the school is located is affected by it. And we're affected by it. We're talking about it. We're concerned about it. I was talking to colleagues today about, you know, they're worried about their children going to school up here in Michigan. So it gets into the psyche of all of us. And so one focus, and we know that 40%, and there is no real profile for mass shooters, but 40% have either have childhood trauma or have been exposed to violence in some way in their community or in their families. And so all of these children now are at greater risk for becoming themselves mass shooters because of this trauma that they have experienced. So we have to have trauma-informed educational context, and we have to think about what does it mean to be exposed in this way in terms of the modeling of the behavior or learning that this is a way to solve problems or losing sleep, becoming less interested in school and less interested in all sorts of activities in normal life because you have experienced this trauma. It's PTSD on steroids, and it stands longer and stays longer with us. So one focus on prevention is thinking about trauma-informed actions, paying attention to the kids who are in that school who may have experienced either trauma in their school or in their families or in their communities.
Yeah, lots of trauma, and the trauma is sort of like molestation. At some point, you're a victim, and then at some point, you may become a victimizer. So it's sort of the gift that keeps giving. And we're always trying to figure out a sort of mechanical approach to it, like less guns or availability of guns, or it's mechanical stuff, you know, reinforcing the school doors or having a security guard. And I'm not going to argue against a lot of that, but as long as we're producing people that think this is a good idea or who are inclined to do this, it shall continue. Mm-hmm. There's just not enough security guards or gun regulations we can put into place to prevent it from happening. We might cut into it some percentage, but I really want to look at the root problem. And then you get into this legislation thing where how do you legislate raising your kids or not, you know, trauma or not traumatizing, or what's the definition of trauma and so on and so forth. Is there any approach that has been effective that we could do as a legislator societal approach?
Well, I mean, just to comment on the idea that there isn't any one solution. And I can't tell you how often I speak to people about this just in my everyday life. And everybody thinks they have the answer. And the problem is so much more complex. And as a society, we haven't done the research that we need to do. We were able to reduce car crashes by 70%, car crash-related deaths by 70% over the last 50 years, because we spent billions of dollars coming up with better, safer cars. We came up with seatbelts. We changed our culture. I don't know if you're old enough to remember when seatbelt laws first went into place and everybody was fighting them and gets into our freedoms and cuts our freedoms off. And now nobody gets into a car that's buckling their seatbelt before they do anything. So it is possible, but I think it takes that kind of commitment. So, you know, what we're trying to do in the Institute is do the kind of research that we need to do to get those kind of evidence base to find out what are programs that might be tailored for certain populations or in certain contexts. And, you know, most of the firearm deaths in our country are suicide related, and most of those occur in rural areas. That's a very different kind of intervention than we might do, or a program that we might do in an inner city. African-American kids are 15 times more likely to die from homicide than a white kid. We do something different for that population that we have to think about. Now, directly answering your question, some of the work that we've done, we do have some evidence that in communities, especially urban communities that have been disinvested, that have lots of vacancy, empty lots, illegal dumping, half burned out houses. I mean, there are cities I've worked in and gone to where I've seen you go down a street and there, instead of 10 houses, there's three occupied houses, five unoccupied and half falling apart and several empty lots with that are overgrown. And so that sort of sends a message that nobody cares about this place, and this is an easy place to do bad things. And so drug cultures may occur, other kinds of nefarious activities that then increase the risk for firearm violence to occur. Those one-offs, that not the mass shootings, but where there is a murder or a gang fight, for example. So what we've done is we work with some local partners in Youngstown and in Flint, Michigan, Youngstown, Ohio, and Camden, New Jersey, where we're looking at what happens if you mow them. Instead of a broken window where one broken window leads to another and leads to the downward spiral of a community, what happens if you build it? What happens if you show that people are paying attention, boarding up houses in ways that you can't necessarily tell that it's boarded up? And so instead of a plywood board on the inside, outside, you put it on the inside and you paint it. Mowing the lawn, planting a garden, doing really simple things we have found that actually reduces violence and reduces firearm violence in particular in those neighborhoods where those kind of activities are happening. Low cost, and it's something that we can do starting tomorrow, and that many communities around the country are doing. We also have an after-school program where we engage kids as part of the solution instead of the focus of the problem. So instead of blaming them and trying to change them, we create opportunities for them to develop leadership skills, to develop community change and community improvement projects. And they have planted gardens, painted murals. In Flint, one of the murals that they've painted is standing for the last 20 years and has not been painted over or graffitiized in any way. And then we study around those places where they've done those kids have done that work. And around those places, crime goes down, violent crime goes down. We also studied and compared the kids who are in that program versus kids who are not in the program. And we find that those kids who are in the program are less likely to engage in delinquent behavior and violent behavior and much more likely to be engaged in school. So there are things we can do that are not expensive, that we have to start kind of building community again and get away from this idea that it's us against them. It's us. And this is, our nation, our communities, and we need to work together to make it happen.
Now, these are very interesting points, and I completely agree. And as you were speaking about the vacant lot and this sort of urban decay and all that, and very simple things, I think we want to go for high-tech solutions or very expensive, sweeping mechanical things, but you're right. Any of the real change, much like I always say, anyone who you run into, you haven't seen them in a year and they drop 40 pounds, you go, what'd you do? And they go, stop drinking soda. And you go, that doesn't sound sexy. And they go, yeah, I just started walking.
But what about cool sculpting?
Just walking more, and I stopped drinking Mr. Pibb. And it's like, that doesn't sound innovative or fun or interesting or like a life hack. And it's like, no, it's just real basic shit. Sort of like, as you were speaking about that, I was thinking about like school uniforms. I don't have the data in front of me, but when they put kids in school uniforms, they tend to fight less and act out less because psychologically, they're in the uniform of their school. Or maybe it's simply that they paid $30 for it. They don't want to tear the sleeve by getting into a brawl on campus. But there's been studies that the school uniform cuts down on the violence and some of the negative interactions and stuff like that. And I think, yeah, it's just a basic sort of human thing. If you're living in this sort of hellscape and it looks like, first off, it just looks like you're not being policed. You've been left alone. Yeah. Nobody. This is a damnation alley you live on for a street. No one is. There's no supervision, presence. Right. There's no presence here. Then, yeah, why not do what I want to do?
Very welcoming for that.
And I agree. I'm curious. We just decided to send $40 billion to Ukraine. We can't carve out, and what you're talking about with getting out the weed whacker and putting the plywood on the inside of the window, this is pretty basic, cheap, make a run to Home Depot kind of stuff, not Tomahawk and Stinger missile, Raytheon kind of money. Why doesn't there seem to be sort of a political motivation for this?
Wow. You know, that now you're I don't know the answer to that. I don't have a really good answer to that. You know, I think part of it's on the researchers to we don't disseminate our information in ways that, you know, in ways like this where we're talking to normal people and not other eggheads who are researchers. I'm among them, not data nerds, but, you know, doing some cost benefit analysis and showing this to be the case. And I think at a local level, that's happening more and more. I think when communities start doing this in their neighborhood and they connect with the police and the police start helping them by patrolling more often and they're cleaning the place up and they're showing, you know, this whole idea that, well, you know, like you said, why not do that? It becomes a place like, oh, I better not do it here. What's interesting is when we've looked at the data, they're not just, you know, people might say, oh, they're just going somewhere else. They're not. We're not finding that it's necessarily going up in other places, it meaning violent crime and gun crime. So I think there are things we can do, and certainly researchers can do a better job communicating what it is. Part of the problem is everybody thinks, I think when it comes around guns, that it's all about gun control and it's like, you can't take my gun away. And, you know, as Charlton Heston said, over my, you know, cold dead fingers or something, but it's not what it's about. I think we can all get behind the idea that we need to reduce firearm death in America. I don't know that I hope there isn't anybody in the United States who believes that we should increase that. And I think what we're trying to do in the Institute is develop the research, the rigorous research that we can defend methodologically, that's good science, that's showing that what is effective and what isn't effective, instead of just sitting around and saying, oh, we should do this, we should do that, we should do this. For example, you know, whether or not you agree with a semi-automatic or automatic weapons ban, and we don't go into whether you agree with that or not, that wouldn't have stopped today's or yesterday's shooting. As far as I know, as far as I've heard, there was not a semi-automatic weapon used in that case. So there's no panacea. That's the point. That's a really important point. There's no panacea, no quick fix. You talked about ERPO laws earlier, the extreme risk protection laws, the red flag laws. We don't really know much about how they work. We do know about 23 or so states have such laws. They're really different. And we don't know if one kind works better than another kind. We don't know how they're implemented at the local level. We need to do that kind of research. We need to commit ourselves as a nation that we will invest in solutions and studying the evidence-based solutions. Just like you wouldn't take a drug just because somebody said this is a good idea. We have to invest like we do at NIH, at the National Institutes of Health, to really cure cancer. It's a moon effort. And that's what it's going to take here. Because again, it's really different. It manifests itself in different ways. The shooting in Buffalo was racism. Underlying racism is pretty clear. What about the one that happened in Texas? Not so much necessarily. We don't know much about that one yet. But so there's different motivations, different issues that occur. And we really have to, I think, get to the bottom of it. If I could take one more minute and just make sure that for our schools, we need to really pay attention to our school climates. And there are efforts at the national level. The Department of Justice has programs and funding that schools can go get to and work with a National Center for School Safety and develop strategies that help create the school climates that are most supportive for kids.
I appreciate your insights, Dr. Mark Zimmerman. You can check out the Institute for Firearm Injury Prevention. That's his institute. And interesting. I've never thought about the sort of broken window thing. And I often think, you know, if you go to a place that's a mess and you're thinking about littering, it's so much easier to flick a cigarette butt or throw when there's litter all over the street. You go into a pristine boardwalk or neighborhood or whatever –
You put that cigarette butt in your pocket.
You will put it. Yes, you will. Like that's just who you are. And I definitely see that psychology as it pertains to these inner cities. So very insightful, very interesting. Thank you, Dr. Mark.
Yeah, thank you. We call that busy streets theory, by the way. If you build it, they will come. If you clean it up, they will not throw their cigarette butts and not getting engaged in those behaviors. But thank you for having me and for the conversation. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Mark Zimmerman. All right, I think we'll take a break. I'll do a quick spot and then we'll talk to Marissa Randazzo, who's probably coming at it from a slightly more law and order or mechanical approach, which is good. We'll get both sides of the story here. First, I'll tell you about BetterHelp. Oh, boy. Never a better time for BetterHelp. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp.
Timely.
Yeah. Many people are burnt out. They don't even know it. And it's not just work. Maybe it's the roles and many, many of the things you do in life can burn you out. BetterHelp wants to remind you to prioritize yourself. Talk with someone to figure out what's causing the stress in your life. BetterHelp. Customize online therapy, offering video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. So you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. More affordable than in-person therapy, and you can get matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. It's time to take care of your head, everybody, so you can take care of the rest of your life and people in it as well. It's BetterHelp, right, Dawson?
Adam Carolla Show listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/Carolla. That's BetterHelp.com/CarolLa.
All right. We'll be back with another expert in this field, Dr. Marissa Randazzo, PhD, I should say, right after this. Would you love to save some money on your insurance? Of course you would. And who doesn't love a deal when it comes to great rates on insurance for everything? GEICO can help. Insurance for your car, truck, motorcycle, boat, RV, even your homeowners, condo, or renter's insurance. They are all covered with GEICO. Save even more with special discounts when you bundle coverages together. Plus, they have an easy-to-use GEICO mobile app and 24/7 roadside assistance, so it's easy to switch to GEICO. It's a no-brainer. Switch today and see just how much you could save at geico.com. Go there and get a rate quote or contact a local agent.
It's time to check Adam's voicemail.
Adam came up with something new and old. You know, one of those things. Docking. Originally, docking meant you're pulling your boat up to the parking space and you're gonna dock. Now, it is the act of putting one's head of their penis inside the foreskin of another penis. So I think we're moving in the right direction.
You can leave us a message at 888-634-1744.
I thought he was going to talk about docking your iPad.
USB. I think that's exactly where I thought it was going.
Well, it must be nice to have such pristine minds. Dr. Marissa Randazzo, PhD, is with us. Let me read some of her bona fides. She is, as I said, and jump in, doctor, if I screw any of this up, 10 years, U.S. Secret Service, the agency's chief research psychiatrist, or psychologist, I should say, co-director of the Safe School Initiative, a federal study of school shootings, and many, many other accolades. So thanks for joining us on short notice.
Oh, my pleasure. Let me add one more. I'm currently the executive director of threat management for Ontic Technologies.
There you go. I will. I'll write that down. So, what have you? What can, with all your vast experience, what can you tell us about what happened in Texas?
So, it's an active investigation. There's still so much that we don't know. Let me tell you what we do know about school shootings generally and where this one is similar so far and where it's different. So I have been studying school shootings since the Columbine shooting in 1999. And actually, we started a study then that went back 25 years earlier. It was part of a group at the Secret Service, and they've continued that research. And there's some findings that we see time and time again about school shootings in the U.S. First and foremost, these people don't just snap. They're not impulsive. They're planned out in advance. Finding shootings that have occurred is that there's often a trail of this planning behavior. People know the shooter has shared these ideas and plans with people around them. I think we just saw information coming out today that the Uvalde shooter had been in contact for daily contact for at least a week or two with a girl in Germany and ended up texting her what he was about to do before he did it. But we often see this planning behavior go on for days, weeks, months, and in some cases, years. That may sound scary. From a prevention angle, it actually is good news. It means we stand a chance at uncovering someone's plans before they do harm. The other big piece that we know, and I just mentioned this, but I want to highlight it, is that prior to shootings like this, the shooter typically tells other people what they're going to do. So there's information out there. Now, the key is the people that they usually tell are peers. They're other kids. So one of the big things we know from dissecting so many of these horrific events is that students are probably our most powerful prevention tool out there, because they are going to know before an adult in school or in the community ever does, and may never do, but students will know. And so part of what we've seen work in the past couple of years is students coming forward when they see something troublesome on Instagram or TikTok or wherever it is, and telling someone, hey, this may be nothing, but I'm not sure. I'm worried. Someone else take a look at it.
Yeah, well, it makes perfect sense. I mean, it's sort of, I always think about sort of patching a leak in the hull of a boat. You can't really do it from the inside. You got to go outside and do it. Otherwise, it's just really not going to be effective. And there's just no, in a sense, nobody knows better than a sibling, a family member, or a peer, for sure, if somebody who's going to do something, and like you said, it's days, it's weeks, it's months. I don't know what the average, it's years. I don't know what the average time is, but it's enough time for somebody to see something and say something.
Well, we had the see something, say something campaign for airplanes, airports, right? Was that what it was?
There's like a terrorist.
Yeah, exactly. And so would this not be something we could implement, like start telling, the same way you told kids to stop, drop, and roll for my entire childhood?
Great analogies. And here's what I'd love. I'd love to see a TikTok challenge where kids come up with quick sayings that apply to a situation like this. So, hey, let's, you know, forget eating Tide Pods and spraying deodorant on your arms. I want to see a challenge where we have students search their creativity, come up with a stop, drop, and roll for this generation about what they can do to share, you know, when they hear about a threat, when they're worried about what a friend's telling them. They don't have to know if the friend is serious or not, but they have to bring it to someone who can do something about it.
Well, then you get into a logistics thing. And it's, you know, going back to terrorists and 9/11, you know, somebody at the flight training school in Florida was saying, hey, these guys want to learn how to take off, but they don't want to learn how to land. And the FBI was like, thank you for your information, or some version of that. You hear about that, unfortunately, time and time again. So how do you physically implement this? Like, do we have enough humans to do this?
We do, but here's where we need the force multiplier, because we saw the same thing you were just talking about in the Buffalo shooting less than 2 weeks ago, that federal law enforcement simply doesn't have the capacity to handle this. And you know who needs training on how to investigate threats is local law enforcement. They often don't get it. They get a lot of training on how to respond to an active shooter. They get training on how to investigate crimes in their community, but they don't get good training on what's called threat assessment, which is the field that I've been in for 28 years. And the Secret Service really helped to define this field. But local law enforcement, local police departments, sheriff's offices don't often get this training. So a big missing piece, if we're going to patch this boat, as you're talking about, is to get training to local law enforcement. If legislators can take any action right now, that's one of the first things they could do that could really help.
Speaking of legislation, gun control, gun regulations, things of that nature. Where's your head on that one?
So I'll tell you, I was thinking back the other day. I somehow can't remember how this even came about, but I was thinking back. I did a report in seventh grade, which was back in like the 1800s at this point. But I did a report in seventh grade on gun control. And I will tell you that the issues that we're hearing debated today were similar to what I did, you know, my seventh grade research paper on. I as much as gun control may be appealing from a legislative standpoint, I think we need much more practical solutions. So here's what does work. A number of states have passed things called extreme risk protection orders, or ERPOs. I think 19 states, maybe 23 states have them now. This is a temporary protection order that separates a dangerous person from their guns until they are stable again.
The red flag
until
laws.
They can be trusted with those weapons again. Red flag laws, absolutely. Those work, but we need them in all 50 states. So state legislatures could take some action now to pass ERPO laws in their states that don't yet have them. Those work and work really well.
What about the physical, literally hardening of the schools? Do you have any thoughts about that?
So this has been a constant debate since Columbine, if not earlier, that hardening the target often doesn't work because of situations where the vast majority of school shooters come from within the schools themselves. So they already know the schools. They know the lockdown drills. They know the active shooter drills. They know where people are going to convene. Some school shootings we've seen have actually factored that into their planning. So hardening the target can make people feel good, but from a practical matter isn't going to do enough, I think. But things that do help, that I've seen help tremendously, are school resource officers in schools, especially where there's some good thought given to the actual officers that serve in those positions. We've seen a whole host of averted school shootings that didn't happen because someone confided in a school resource officer. They didn't feel like they could trust the principal. They didn't want to bring it to a teacher. They didn't know how the school personnel would react, but they knew that school resource officer that was in their building every day or patrolling their grounds a couple of times a week, and they trusted that person to bring it forward. So school resource officers can be helpful not only from a deterrent standpoint, but also as a trusted individual inside the school walls that students may be more inclined to talk to rather than someone who could discipline them or grade them.
I have a thought about that. I'm just wondering what you think. When this subject is discussed, it's often not discussed with the nuance that you're bringing to it and the other things we can do. It's usually people assume that everybody wants their guns taken away, or we should do an arms race and arm all the teachers and arm everybody. Do you have thoughts on that kind of black and white thinking?
It doesn't help this at all. I'm glad you raised that because it doesn't help this debate. Unfortunately, this is a problem that we have seen has continued, if not increased, in our country. So a black and white approach to any of this doesn't work. But here's a couple of things I want people to understand that help, because the nuance here is important. The majority, vast majority of people who carry out these shootings in schools especially, do so where they're at a point of being suicidal. They have lost hope. They don't care what happens to them anymore. We already have tools within our communities, in our laws, and in our medical and mental health care system to help someone who's at that point of desperation. So we already have tools that we could repurpose here to help someone who is feeling that point of desperation. I want to be clear, not everyone who's suicidal is going to be harmful to someone else. They're not at risk to other people, but there are a subset of cases where people are thinking, my life is miserable. I don't care what happens to me anymore. I'm going to kill myself. I might as well exact some revenge at the same time or get some notoriety on my way out, become famous. That's often a secondary motive. But the primary motive is that these are people who have problems that they feel they can't cope with anymore. They feel overwhelmed. Now, ironically, when we have threat assessment teams in schools, the teams, the adults can take a look at it and say, oh, we can help solve this and this. We can postpone that. They're problems that actually are quite solvable. but from the would-be shooter's perspective, feel overwhelming, and they just feel like I'm giving up and I don't care what happens to me anymore, or I want to kill myself and I'm going to do it in a very public way and take others out with me.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I thought about this similar scenario when the idea of arming the teachers came up, and I was like, don't these the vast majority, it turns out, of the school shooters, public shooters, mass shooters, they end up dead anyway. You know what I mean? So is a deterrent, a person with a gun is not much of a deterrent. Like, I'm going to get shot or killed. Big deal.
I think that's just trying to lessen the body count. I think they're trying to shoot them before they shoot the rest of the kids.
Yeah, but
Adam, let me add this. Law enforcement has to go qualify with their firearms every month to be able to.
I'm not supporting.
To use them. I don't think a teacher's.
I'm not supportive of that notion. I'm just saying. I think that the plan behind it is that. But that being said, if somebody was former law enforcement or military or had the credentials in their background, someone like you. And you were my, you know, kid's biology teacher, and you did go through the recertification yearly thing, I would feel a certain level of comfort knowing that you had this thing on you that it, if the shit went down, you know, we may lessen the body count. But we're getting into the weeds a little bit, but do we agree that the resource officers who are armed... I'm guessing we're talking about police.
Typically,
essentially, should that just be common fare now? That, you know, when I grew up, I had a junior high and a high school, and there was a guy with a windbreaker, and mostly his biggest weapon was the amount of keys he had.
He had
a ball of keys that could kill anyone at a certain range.
And he was mostly concerned with where you were parking.
Right. But he was just kind of on your ass for whatever you were wearing or
don't
whatever.
Run.
Yeah. Right. Or not running. He told everyone not to run. But is it your belief that a certain amount, maybe one per 500 students or one per 1,000 students or some ratio, who is armed and qualified, obviously, should be on these campuses?
I think they can be a tremendous help. Now, they're not without their own controversy. And we've had a couple of high-profile incidents in the past few years of school resource officers or law enforcement in schools doing some, you know, arresting a six-year-old or doing something ridiculous. Now, there is a National Association of School Resource Officers that sets standards for how schools should hire, contract with, have a memorandum of understanding with the police department. They set some standards for how this should be done. And the majority of school resource officers do a great job and actually can serve as that sort of unschool personnel go-to within the school walls. Different communities set them up different ways. You may have one person in every high school and then someone else patrolling other campuses. However, a community, local law enforcement can staff that need, I think it can be immensely helpful.
Well, it's something, you know, politically, I don't hear it brought up that often. It does come up, but we jump right to gun controls and, you know, we get really caught up in, is it automatic? Is it a semi-automatic? These are weapons of war. Nobody needs it, whatever. We don't seem to get into some of the more just sort of less sexy and more pragmatic discussions.
It's the ground and pound of the debate. You know what I mean? Like, you're all of a sudden you say, oh, the guy had an automatic rifle. Was an automatic rifle. Now we're debating what the fuck weapon he had.
Yeah, most of the time they have handguns. But school and so politically, is there anyone who's pushing back one side or the other against the resource officer?
There had been some groups last summer that very vocal, but I think a really small minority pushing back on the school resource officers. And in response, this is in part after the murder of George Floyd and concern about law enforcement and overreach of power and law enforcement led homicide. So it was sort of bound up in all that. And I know a number of schools decided to start this past fall without their school resource officers. And every single one that I know of reinstated them after a couple of weeks, realized that actually they were really helpful and just kind of keeping the temperature turned down with disruptive behavior, the not running part, you know, that's not their job, but it just having that presence and that visibility help to keep things much more under control. And I think especially important right now when kids are back in school after such a crazy 2 years of remote and hybrid and concerns about health problem at all kinds of stuff. Kids and teachers and administrators are bringing a whole bunch of stress, 2 years plus of stress back into the school buildings with them. To get rid of school resource officers this past fall was a huge mistake, and schools have backtracked and put them back in. So I think it's perfect timing for us to really think about that as a resource. But I'll tell you, there's some schools that are doing some creative stuff where they're using local, like they'll use dads from a community, like, or, mm-hmm. or if we've got retired law enforcement, military, someone who, in the community who may not have a kid at the school, but wants to do some help, to come in and just kind of spend a couple hours every week walking the halls, getting to know the kids, making sure things are okay, just adding to those eyes and ears from the community. So if you don't have a school resource officer, your school decides they don't want to, what can you use from the community as volunteers to just be in and be more of an adult presence at the same time too?
We reported on a story like that. It seemed, at least from the feel good angle they were presenting it from, a fabulous idea with these dads, or, you know, whatever parents were available that had a little gravitas to them. And I would think that since apparently we don't have a ton of fear, for lack of a better word, of teachers. I don't know, like, I kind of feel like I did, we did. There's that presence is going to, I would imagine, do two things. Deter some kids from making a big mistake and make the other kids feel safe. So what's the downside?
Right. And communities can just start doing it. I mean, you know, get parent volunteers to go do it. So that's something that community members can take matters into their own hands and say, look, for the next couple of days of school week, whatever we have left, we're going to do this. Let's talk about doing this in the fall. At the same time, parents especially can start asking their schools, do you have a threat assessment team? Now, in Texas, it's actually been a law since, I think, late 2018, 2019, that every public school in Texas has to have access to some threat assessment team. They actually call them safe and supportive school program teams, but they have to do threat assessment. So threat assessment is, again, stuff that we teach. My team has taught thousands of personnel in Texas since that law passed. I don't know what happened in the Uvalde case specifically, but that's another thing that parents can be asking. They can do volunteering in schools to help just be a presence in the hallway at pickup, at drop off, all of those. But they can start asking, does my kid's school have a threat assessment team? If not, let's figure out how we can get some things into place. And I will tell you, there are corporations now saying, look, if this is a budget issue, our kids go to these schools locally, we'll come in and fund it. We'll pay to have this training come in.
What's your take off campus, other shootings, supermarket shootings, inner city violence, just generally outside of the mass school shootings? Yeah.
So mass shootings generally, so outside of school settings, mass shootings generally, we saw in Buffalo, Las Vegas, things that happen in the community, Pulse nightclub, things like that. They often follow a very similar trajectory, meaning they're planned in advance. People know about the planning behavior, and the shooter tells other people about their plans beforehand, sometimes in great detail, sometimes more circumspect. But again, they're often driven by desperation. One thing we've seen in extremist violence, so this came out in Buffalo, was that, you know, this is a person driven by extremist ideology, but a lot of what we know about what attracts people to that extremist ideology is people who, and especially men and young men and boys, who may actually be sort of have a diagnosable clinical depression. Let me explain real quick because it sounds confusing. The symptoms of depression in boys and men often come out as anger, trigger temper, level, like attraction to hate, anger. It's not what we often see, you know, what we see in a movie setting is can't get out of bed, eating all the ice cream, like sort of that's more typical for, you know, female depression. Depression in men and depression in boys is often active. It's anger, it's trigger temper, it's rage, it's hatred and attraction to hate. So one of the things that we've seen with people driven by extremist ideology, like in Buffalo, is that there may, that actually may be a sign of an underlying depression. We can get that person connected to the right mental health care, maybe some medication or therapy, something like that. You clear up that depression and that attraction to that extremist ideology tends to go away.
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, obviously it's exclusively males doing this. I know we can carve
not
out.
Not exclusively,
well,
primarily.
I shouldn't say exclusively. I know there's always the one we haven't heard of. But
we have that couple in San Fernando, and that's all I can think of.
If we could get guys to stop this, we'd be doing pretty good in general, and violence in general. It's I think Mark Garagos's dad, who used to be, a prosecutor, would say, you know, if you just locked up every male between, like, 18 and 32, there'd be zero. You could literally walk the streets with five Rolexes on.
Bye, honey. See you in 14 years.
Every night. There'd just be, would there be no more violence. But you always think about it as rage and weaponized online and acting out and stuff. But yeah, I don't think of it as depression. Women's, what we are using right as society's yardstick to measure depression, that yardstick is pink.
Yeah.
We used a woman's Hollywood version of, oh, I was in a fetal position and I didn't even leave the house for 3 days and I just ate Haagen-Dazs right out of the tub, you know. But the guy's version of depression is anger and fists and acting out and rage.
Well, and isn't that what they say? Boys act out, girls act in. So you're going to have to look for them differently.
Yeah, so some sort of, you know, national attempt to focus on essentially male depression. Not that we don't feel sorry for the ladies, but you don't pose the threat that males pose when they're depressed, evidently.
Exactly. And this is what's behind, you know, domestic violence. This is what's behind, you know, sort of these concerns about toxic masculinity, that attraction to this ideology and this rage is may actually be a symptom of underlying depression. And so even to get, you know, screening instruments so that, you know, family doctors can do a quick couple of questions for every male patient they see. Pediatricians can do the same thing for young men and boys. You can do it with girls too, but I think having a depression screening question as part of regular medical care would be really helpful as well.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's all roads lead back to psychological and family structures and units and community and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, we want to remove the instrument, basically, but it's really the player of the instrument that we got to get to. And it's just ass backwards way. Yeah, everything's right. It's a combination of everything. So when it comes to, like, physically hardening schools, you don't think that would have much effect? Or did I hear you right?
No, it's that we saw a real push for metal detectors after Columbine, for example. And one of the things that we found quickly is boys especially like to figure out ways around it. And so you go in and talk to a couple of boys in any given school and they've figured out how to get stuff around it into windows, how to bypass it. It can actually inadvertently create a prison feel to schools. And one of the things that actually helps to reduce levels of violence in schools, including school shootings, is having a positive climate where the students feel like they can trust the adults, or at least there's some adults they can go to and trust. And if you make it more of a prison feel, it feels like it's us against them. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't help much from the hardening target, again, because typically your threats are from within. And it actually can have kind of an adverse impact on how trusting students feel their school is to them.
So hardening of the target, not much there, in your opinion. School resource officers, good thing.
Depression screening.
Depression screening and, you know, prevention, obviously, a good thing. Where are you on guns, availability, laws, 18 versus 21 years of age, extended clips and automatic versus, you know, a single shot thing or AR-15 type rifle versus a hunting rifle? Where do you come down on that stuff?
Well, let me go back to the research we did when I was with the Secret Service. We looked at how these school shooters got their guns, and 2/3 got them from their own home or a relative's home. It was relatively easy access. For the other third, it was not difficult. They had a friend who was of age who could buy them for them, or they were able to purchase the weapons directly. So I don't know about you. When I was growing up, I could find all kinds of street drugs in New York City, but I wouldn't have known where to go to buy a weapon. And it's not what we're seeing is for kids who carry this out, it's not hard for them to find it, even if those weapons are secured within their own home. Now, I do want to emphasize for people who are living in homes with weapons, it is paramount to make sure they are secured. Even if you think your kid can't find them, chances are they already know where they are. And so gun safes, lock boxes, trigger locks, whatever you can use. I would highly encourage anyone listening who has a weapon in their home, make sure it's secure. Make sure the kid doesn't know where the key is. Make sure, even if you think your kid would never find the weapon, chances are they already know where it is. So make it that much harder if you own weapons already. What I would tell you is that when you look at the prevalence of mass shootings in our country versus other westernized countries, we have the same levels of depression and problems that they do. We have cornered the market on mass shootings. And the one differentiator here is that it is very easy for people of all ages to buy weapons here legally, illegally, and weapons that we're talking about of real mass casualty caliber. So what we've seen, the change in recent years, is that the fatality counts have gone up so much higher than shootings we have seen in decades prior. And it's in part because of the large capacity, because the fully automatic aspects that these weapons being used now are capable of much greater volume of lethality than was possible, you know, a couple of decades ago, a couple of years ago.
So it's everything.
So what would you implement if you had a magic wand?
If I had a magic wand, a couple of things. So first and foremost, if I had a magic wand, I would make sure all local law enforcement is trained in threat investigations. I would have extreme risk protection orders in every state. I would get rid of assault weaponry, and I'd make that incredibly difficult to access, but for our military personnel and our law enforcement who need it. That's my personal opinion. And I'm sure I'm going to get flack for that. And that's part of the problem, is that even expressing opinions is polarizing. And I've certainly been threatened for expressing opinions. And it's so easy to do this, you know, throw shade, harassment, threats online, et cetera. But I would also love to see I'd love to see something creative, like we've got great suicide hotlines in place. Can we implement something like a mass shooting hotline? Mm-hmm. I have worked hundreds, if not thousands, of threat cases in my career. And especially when I work cases of a kid in school who has made a threat, oftentimes what we hear is, I'm having these thoughts and I don't know what to do about them. And it's not the same as a delusion or hearing voices. It's sort of these intrusive thoughts. Like, I'm thinking about, you know, killing this kid who's been bullying me for all year. And so I started to do some research, and I read up on other, you know, like the Columbine killers, and they felt the same way. And then I started to read about their planning, and I thought, well, maybe this is something I have to do. Kids have these thoughts, and then they start researching these thoughts, and then they come to the conclusion that, oh, this must be me too. And so if we had a place where you could call a hotline and say, hey, I'm having these thoughts, I don't want them, or they're scaring me, or I'm worried I might act on them, just like we do with suicide hotlines, you've got someone in place who can say, hey, I'm here to listen. I've talked with people who had planned attacks and they were stopped, and they say, look, I want to get the word out that these thoughts are, you know, they're concerning, but you don't have to act on them. And how can I help kids who are having the same types of thoughts? So there are some creative things we can do out there that aren't being done. And I'd love to see any of these take hold.
Well, it always drives me nuts, and I've mentioned it 1,000 times, but in LA, we have this cadre of freeway, electronic freeway signs, and all they ever say is click it or ticket on there.
Some nonsense relating to the holiday or something.
Slow for the cone zone, something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. How
buzz
about
driving is drunk driving.
Yes. How about put a little, and I argue that if buzz driving is drunk driving, then sober driving is buzz driving.
Thank
so
you.
I don't sign off on that. But I would say go ahead and put some information on there. Feeling sad?
Yeah.
Call this number.
Yeah. And just to add to what you said about, that's a great idea with the hotline, because I've called suicide prevention on somebody's behalf before, and I needed support on how I was supposed to deal with this. And so anyone could call who was afraid anyone was going to do something insane and get that support so they know how to personally interact with them.
Yeah, it strikes me that the person that's going to call is the mom who's
right.
driving home from work with the depressed kid at home.
Right.
That's the person that's going to use the hotline, not the kid
right.
per se. A lot of interesting thoughts and food for thoughts. Marissa Rendazzo. All right. Rendazzo. I put an N when I put a second N in there when I
just
shouldn't
say
have.
Doctor.
Doctor. The
Dr. Marissa.
Director of Threat Management for ONTIC Technologies. And you can shoot her a tweet, especially if you disagree with her her gun
that's
buyback
right.
and mandatory confiscation.
Is that what she said?
That's what I heard.
Oh. Adam, I think I said guns for women only. I think we decided that that's really the ultimate solution here. We're not trying to take away guns from women because they're not the problem.
Yeah.
With that controversial statement.
Great button for the
for
segment.
A change, they're not the problem. Doctor, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate you carving out.
Thank you for having me. Thanks.
All right. Bill Bellamy's not in the building yet, but we'll soldier on. First, I'll tell you about Blinds Galore. They got a huge Memorial Day weekend sale. Yeah. Whoa, it's upon us now. It is coming up. It's on. It started a day or two ago. High-quality blinds, shades, and shutters, custom-built to your exact measurements. Nothing until you order it. Just take your measurements, and you can customize it online. Family-owned and run for nearly 25 years. They're the experts. I have these guys' products in my master bedroom. If there's a window up high and you got a shade, you can have an electronic shade and you can charge it and it lasts a long time. And you don't have to heat it up. You don't have to run wiring to it or bust open the walls or anything. You can work it off your phone. You can work it off the remote. If you have any questions, they're experts and they're customer care experts. They'll help you every step of the way, either online or over the phone. So let's get in on the big sale. Am I right, Dawson?
Order your free samples today so you'll be ready when their Memorial Day sale starts this week and everything will be up to 50% off. Visit blindsgalore.com and let them know that Adam sent you. That's blindsgalore.com.
All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.
All this month, stream the funniest films for free on Pluto TV. Watch comedy classics like Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy, and Mean Girls. Or drop in for a Tyler Perry marathon with a Madea family funeral and Madea's witness protection. Pluto TV also has hundreds of channels and thousands of movies and TV shows like Get Shorty, Be Cool, Key and Peele, Comedy in Color, and more. And no contracts, no subscriptions, no fees, no joke. So download the Pluto TV app on your favorite streaming device and start laughing today. Pluto TV, drop in, watch free.